This is a CBC podcast. With all the great programming on CBC Radio, it's hard to decide which podcasts to download. So why not subscribe to the Editor's Choice podcast? Get a carefully selected highlight every day from cbc.ca/podcasting.
Hi, I'm Todd Lussier from Algonquin Park. Spark was taped before a live hairy woodpecker pecking at my window.
One. This is your life.
Two.
This is your digital life.
Three.
This is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
Hi, I'm Nora Young, and on Spark this time around, remember the Rubik's Cube? Well, it's back in a new form to torture you again. We'll find out why puzzles like this can help your spatial intelligence. Plus, what's your guide when it comes to movie recommendations? One trusted reviewer or one of those websites that average movie reviews into a handy-dandy score? Why reducing reviews to a number may get two thumbs down from film fans. But we start with a love story, and maybe it's one that you can relate to. This is the love story of the techie spouse.
My name is Bill Buxton, and I'm married to the artist Elizabeth Russ.
And the non-techie spouse.
My name is Elizabeth Russ, and I'm married to Bill Buxton, so far.
Bill, the techie spouse, is a principal researcher at Microsoft. He spends a lot of time thinking about the role of computers in our lives. So first of all, how would you describe your own relationship with computers?
It's a love affair that's full of frustration. It's sort of like life.
It's been a passion for him for years and years. So most every day begins with him firing it up and joined at the hip most of his waking hours.
Bill's wife Liz, the non-techie spouse, is an artist. And how about Liz's relationship to computers? How would you describe that?
Projectiles to throw at me, I think.
I have a hard time with it. It's a necessary evil for me in my work, so I'm sure my adrenal glands need some attention for stress.
Do you wish that she were more interested in digital technology, or that was an interest that you shared?
It's an interesting question. In a way, yes, in a way, no. Actually, the thing I like the best about her is that she has really different interests than me, and therefore it prevents me becoming even more obsessive than I am in things I do. But I'd say that if I look in the household, the way the technology exists is that on the one hand, it's a thing that lets us achieve some of the things we value the most in terms of our style of life and our quality of living. And at the same time, it's one of the things that, it's not even a digital divide. She described it as a digital divorce.
And so how do you negotiate that difference just as a couple?
We make a point of designating a time where we both ignore technology. And if it eats into that, where we don't have sort of where let's go out for dinner and catch up on our week, even though we're under the same roof, we're at various odds and ends of our lives. If we let that slip, that's bothersome to us both.
Liz is like a lot of people. She uses digital technology in her life, but it's not a passion. We take it for granted couples have to navigate their different interests, where one spends every weekend playing in a band, say, and the other isn't interested. Maybe digital technology is the latest gap that couples have to negotiate. Now, when I was talking to Bill and Liz, I asked them,
did you know about this difference in your orientation towards technology when you got married?
No, because I don't think the world was as computerized in those days.
And she's right. While people have long started out relationships seeing if they have much in common, measuring your technological compatibility with someone is a thoroughly modern relationship issue.
Isn't it the strangest thing that the internet's only been in our lives the last, 15, 20 years or so? And so here we are talking about how technology affects our relationships. And yes,
that's Tawana Hines. She's a sex, dating, and relationships writer who blogs at funkybrownchick.com. She says technological compatibility is something you should consider from day one in a relationship.
And I guess in a way, you do have those conversations about other areas of interest. Like you might, on a first date, try and figure out if a person's interested in sports or that kind of thing. So really, it is just another interest.
Exactly, such as seeing films or music or anything like that.
So what are some of the ways that a technology gap can actually cause, stress in a relationship?
Well, on the more severe end, of course, there's internet addiction. And if it's at that level, definitely that's harmful for a relationship. But on the lesser end of that scale is maybe someone's into playing internet games a little bit more than you are, and you wanted to go to a movie, but they're like, hey, babes, I got to finish up the game. And so things like that. So it could definitely affect a relationship.
Mm-hmm. I guess, if it isn't even necessarily a question of addiction, but that sort of, I can confess to having certain sort of compulsive aspects in my internet behavior that I think could possibly be kind of difficult for the other person to understand. Yeah.
Oh, don't I know it. I blog, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, and my friends have actually called that cord that leads from my laptop to the wall my umbilical cord. So I could be in that group too.
So if you have this kind of gap in your relationship, how can couples manage it?
The very first thing is to talk about it. And as I mentioned earlier, it might seem like a strange thing to talk about. Hey, are you going to update your Facebook status to say that we're dating? But this was a strange thing to talk about with television and all new media at some point changes from being something that's bizarre, weird, quirky, seen as kind of a weird thing that wouldn't affect relationships or shouldn't be talked about in relationships to being an everyday conversation. And so the very first thing is talking about it and realizing doing so is not bizarre and it can actually help your relationship, not hurt it. And then after that, it's more about negotiating, negotiating how much time you'll spend on the line together, separately, and what your identities will be together as a couple. How public are you going to be online?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, there can be sort of advantages of learning to like your spouse's technical interests. Rick, who commented at our blog about meeting up after shopping with his non-techie spouse, wrote, "She reaches into her purse and pulls out an Apple Airport Express Wi-Fi base station. That was a damn sexy moment, that was." So it could actually be good for the relationship.
Exactly, because what could be even more sexy than finding out your partner has an interest? You know, and because you care about them, you want to know more about this interest, so you kind of peek into it a little bit. That can make them feel closer to you, because it's not just what they're doing, whether it's technology, whether it's you ski, they ski, whatever. It's an activity that you're building together as a couple that would strengthen it.
Thanks, Twana.
You're welcome.
You can find a link to Twana Hines' blog at our blog, cbc.ca/spark.
The snow is snowing and the wind is blowing, but I can weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? For I've got my love to keep me warm.
Okay. Here's another technology gap scenario. You're in your home office. You're working away on your computer, and
your partner or kids call it. I'm like, Bill, you're always on your computer.
That's Bill Buxton again. Now, Bill isn't just interested in computers. As principal researcher with Microsoft, he thinks a lot about how human relations are helped or not by computers. Maybe that technology gap isn't your fault, oh geeky listener. Maybe it's the way the computer is designed.
Why is it that in the households we grew up with, where computers weren't there, that we never heard our parents calling out each other, Bill, you're always on your pencil? And it sounds like an absurd comparison until you actually step back and think for a moment and say, well, actually, almost every activity that I do today using my PC, I used to do using a pencil. But when I'm working on the computer, you have no idea whether I'm writing a love letter to my wife, whether I'm booking a holiday, whether I'm doing the income tax, writing the great Canadian novel, drawing, or whatever. You have no idea what the activity is, because all you see is the computer. Yet when I was using the pencil, doing exactly the same activities, you could tell if I was doing a crossword puzzle or whether I was writing down a recipe or writing music even versus a letter and so on and so forth, because there was all these other spatial cues that defined the activity.
So what do you think it is about the typical household computer in particular that this kind of what are you doing on your computer all the time problem can happen?
I think it all stems from the fact that it's like the super appliance. It's like the Cuisinart or the Swiss Army knife with a gazillion blades. It's trying to be all things to all people. And the problem is everything's anchored to that single device and to that single location. So the device itself dominates. And in essence, that's why I think a lot about this notion about, instead of some weak general device, a strong specific devices, things that are specialized for these different purposes, each has its own location. we can get back to those other attributes, which I think are really important to break us away from this seeming obsession with the tool.
So what would that look like to have strong sort of single-purpose devices in different areas of your home? Can you flesh that out a little for me?
Absolutely. Take my mother as an example. She's 89 years old, loves music, can't get the music she wants. No matter how fancy the computer, the software, streaming, audio network, she will never, ever, ever take streaming audio and music over, off the web, even though everything she would ever want to listen to is there.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's rewind a bit. What's a radio? Oh, it's a browser. What kind of browser? A browser specialized specifically for streaming audio.
Hmm.
What are the radio buttons on your car radio? Oh, those are bookmarks. And so all of a sudden I realize that by the form and the design of that particular specialized device, my mother has been able to work a browser with streaming audio off the net with bookmarks since before I was born. It's just that the network happened to be AM or FM as opposed to the WWW network. And the power of that browser that we call a radio or tuner is precisely because it is useless for doing your income tax. You cannot read email. You can't do any of this other garbage. It does. It is what it is. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. It's not a browser. It's not a computer. If you can tell there's a computer in it, it's probably a failure of design and likely to soon be an anachronism.
Mm. Interesting. Bill, thanks so much.
That's my pleasure.
Oh, and one other thing. Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you.
So what are your Valentine's Day plans? Dinner and a movie? Well, if you do head to your local Gigaplex to cuddle up with a large popcorn and a gallon of pop, tell me this. How do you decide which movie to see? Do you check your local paper, ask your friends, or do you head online to a website like Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic? These sites are what they call review aggregators. So instead of hopping from review to review, you can get lots of opinions in one convenient website. So on Metacritic, each review is converted into a score out of 100, and these scores are added together and averaged to create a Metascore. Prominent reviewers are given more weight than not-so-prominent reviewers. On Rotten Tomatoes, each review is turned into a tomato. Good reviews mean fresh tomatoes, bad reviews mean, you got it, rotten tomatoes. And while these types of review aggregators are good for getting a quick temperature reading on a movie, it all seems a bit reductionist, you know? What gets lost when you convert a carefully considered, well-written film review to a two-digit number or a point on the tomato meter? Or is it tomato meter?
It is a little bit of a problem when you're looking at a movie in the same way you might look at a Zagat restaurant guide.
That's David Edelstein. He's the chief film critic for New York Magazine, and he says this kind of review aggregation quantifies what should really be beyond quantification.
Speaking for myself, what I've loved about critics, what I've loved about reading criticism, what I love about writing criticism is the individual response, is the kind of quirky individual response, is developing a relationship with an individual critic, an individual writer, playing off your own perceptions against that person's, entering the world of that person. I believe, you know, great criticism can be a work of art in and of itself. And there is something a little depressing about jumping around from one critic to the next, to the next, to the next, and then kind of looking at the overall score. It shouldn't be the same as political polls, should it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't think it should be.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make me happy, but maybe I'm speaking, you know, egocentrically.
Well, I guess that's the question. I can certainly understand why film critics would not be happy about this, but what do you think the implications are for film lovers or for films themselves?
Well, I mean, nobody really knows. I mean, I would love to be able to project myself into the future and say that this is going to change our relationship to the medium. What's missing is, you know, the thing that I used to do when I read a Pauline Kael review, for example, in The New Yorker. I would go off and see the movie. I wouldn't read it first. I would maybe get a general sense of whether she liked it or not. I'd see the movie. And then I would rush home and I would open my magazine and compare my own perceptions to hers. And maybe I would say, yeah, I thought of that, but she put it into words so much better, so much more passionately than I could ever have. Or maybe I would read it and say, what the heck is she talking about? This woman's crazy, which happened a lot too. you know, I miss that sense of excitement that this criticism is this special thing, like a book that you rush back to and compare and contrast your own perception. So much of what critics can teach people is the ability to explain their reactions to themselves. Hmm. There's just this complicated dynamic there that I think is missing when you rely solely on these aggregating sites.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's a problem with averaging in general in the way that it kind of blandifies things, right? Like if I see a movie that's got, say, a 5 out of 10 rating, I'm probably going to ignore it. But what if what's really going on there is that, you know, I don't know, it's a Lars von Trier movie and half the people thought it was a 10 and the other half of the people thought it was a 0, you know, that
sure,
in some ways it winnows
exactly
at the extremes.
Look, there are critics out there who probably their taste is very consistent with the top-rated films on the tomato meter because they have radar for what the public is going to respond to. It's always more interesting when you find some critic who's going to make a case, even if it's an insane case, because we've all seen things that we've responded to and said, gee, I really like that. And then we've looked at the reviews and the reviews have been, you know, pooping all over it or vice versa. We've gone to see a really hyped movie and said, gee, I don't get that. And the scores do not reflect that. Maybe I'm a hypocrite because, look, I rely on the aggregators, too, in fields that I don't know as well as I know movies. I think we just have to realize that it's not enough. It's not everything. It doesn't replace the quirky, funny, outrageous, annoying individual voice that so often, you know, can be a real creative response. Criticism can be a very creative medium.
David, thanks so much for talking to us.
You're very welcome.
David Edelstein is a chief film critic for New York Magazine. If you want to know what David thinks about the future for professional film criticism in this crazy online world of aggregation and recommendation engines, you can find a longer version of that conversation up at the Spark blog. And that's also where you can weigh in. Please let me know who you trust when you go to the movies. You'll find it all at cbc.ca/spark. So what do the meta reviewers think about this meta criticism?
I am Mark Doyle. I am one of the co-founders of Metacritic.com. It's an absolutely valid point of view that a lot of these critics never intended there to be a score in their reviews. And if they don't like it, I mean, that's absolutely fair. It's just a tool, and we're just doing our best to estimate for our users so that they, you know, knowing that oftentimes movies here in the U.S. especially cost $15 and $16 a film, that they have the most education they can get ahead of time going into a purchase.
From the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, this is Spark. cbc.ca/spark.
The Rubik Cube, that multicolored toy confounding kids and adults, has become one of Canada's great pastimes.
In the 80s, everyone, and I mean everyone, was in love with the Rubik's Cube. And we've since bought more than 350 million cubes. Basically, everyone who ever wanted a Rubik's Cube has one.
The aim is to solve the puzzle by matching the colored segments along the six sides.
I mean, it looks simple enough, but how many of us to this day still can't say we've ever managed to finish it?
There are 42 quintillion. That's 42 million, million, million possible patterns which can be made on the surface of the cube.
And now Erno Rubik, the Hungarian inventor of the cube and countless other puzzles, has just announced his latest brain buster. This is it. It's called the Rubik's 360, and it'll be in toy stores this summer. But we've been in a battle of wits with this baby for a week now. Now, basically, the Rubik's 360 is a transparent sphere with a smaller sphere inside and a smaller sphere inside that. The big outer sphere, it has six colored half circles on it, like bubbles. And inside the smallest of the sphere within a sphere within a sphere, if you get me, are six tiny colored balls. So what you do is try to get the tiny colored balls out of the inner sphere and into the matching colored bubbles outside.
Oh!
Don't we have enough problems in life without having to tackle something like the Rubik's 360?
Uh-huh. People do puzzles to test themselves, first of all. we're faced with challenges every day in life, and we just muddle through the best we can. Most challenges we have in everyday life don't have perfect solutions, and even when we do get a good solution, we just sort of jump in the middle of the problem, whatever it is, and move things along and then go on to something else.
Well, sure. That's what Will Shortz would say.
I'm crossword editor of the New York Times.
So I suppose he would know why our love affair with puzzles continues even today.
With a Rubik's Cube or a crossword or Sudoku or any sort of human-made puzzle, you see the process through from start to finish. And when you get that final perfect answer, it gives you a very satisfying feeling.
But beyond that, it got me wondering whether there's any actual benefit to solving this Rubik's 360, if solving it would do any good for my brain. Now, where is a conveniently located cognitive neuroscientist when you need one?
My name's Philip Servos. I am a professor of cognitive neuroscience, a Canada research chair at Wilfrid Laurier University, and I'm also a professor of psychology there.
Beautiful. Who better to ask about puzzles in the brain?
Hi, Philip.
Hello.
I want to get an important question out of the way. Have you ever solved the original Rubik's Cube?
If I said yes, I would be a liar.
So you're a cognitive neuroscientist, and you study how the brain works using functional MRI machines that sort of take images of the brain.
Yes.
I don't suppose we'd be lucky enough that anyone's ever put a Rubik's Cube player under the fMRI machine.
I don't know of any study that looked at that, although it's actually quite a fascinating question. Certainly people have studied other spatial tasks, and we have a fairly good handle on what parts of the brain are involved in that. So probably the Rubik's Cube, I would think, would piggyback on similar neural structures in the parietal cortex.
Can you tell me what we know about what that part of the brain does?
The first thing to remember is that it receives two major sensory inputs from the tactile system, so the touch system, and inputs from the visual system. So so-called visuomotor control, if you're drinking a cup of coffee right now, how you get your arm oriented to pick up that cup of coffee and so on. But it has also many other functions that I could bore you with. But, you know, one thing is related back to the Rubik's Cube. It has functions related to spatial transformations.
Can you sort of describe what this kind of spatial manipulation and spatial intelligence is?
It's probably a myriad of different specialized abilities and so on. So somebody that is good at route finding in a city may not be so good at doing the Rubik's Cube, for example. So there are multiple facets to spatial intelligence, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think these processes are critical for the Western world, for science and for culture. Think about the thousands of hours that children spend in school learning how to read, which is obviously fundamental and important, but I was replaying my education, and I never took any kind of visualization course,
mm-hmm.
any kind of education on how to do three-dimensional things in my head, as it were. You know, once in a while in math, you might throw it out a little bit, or physics, but very little. And it seems to me that's a real lacuna in the curriculum.
And so if I do these spatial puzzles more, can I actually improve my spatial abilities?
I should think so. It's like any other form of learning. I think if you apply yourself to it, I suppose your parietal cortex would subtly change it in some ways.
So if, you know, you have these cube champions who can solve the Rubik's Cube in 8 seconds or when they're blindfolded or whatever,
right.
Would that skill still be paying off in terms of brain development?
Probably less likely for them, since, you know, they're so good at it and so on.
Right.
So we need a four-dimensional Rubik's Cube for them to challenge them, I guess.
Right. You know, Philip, it occurs to me that now it's pretty easy to sort of cheat or sort of shortcut your way into solving the Rubik's Cube because the web has hundreds and hundreds of tutorials that'll basically walk you through the solution.
Right.
But what, I mean, I guess maybe from from a brain health function or from
right.
a philosophical perspective, what's the risk of taking the shortcut to puzzle solving rather than, so to say, puzzling it out?
Yeah, I guess it has to do with how important the Rubik's Cube is for spatial development, because there's probably many other tasks that people could train themselves on to, you know, as fascinating as the Rubik's Cube is, it's... But it is interesting. I mean, there aren't that many avenues for exercising our spatial abilities. I have, you know, an Apple product that I carry around with me that has a GPS on it. And so even for route finding now, when, you know, making a transformation between the map on your lap when you're in the car and figuring out where you are,
mm-hmm.
Figuring out north and south and that sort of thing, I actually enjoy doing that personally. And yet now, you know, the GPS, it actually even gets rid of the spatial code. It's a verbal code, essentially, right? It says, you know, go for 2 minutes here, turn
right.
left there. So in the end, if you miss a turn, you're screwed, because how do you, you know, you don't have a mental model of where you are. You've just followed slavishly a verbal algorithm as opposed to using the spatial information. So the irony is, I think, you know, there's more a need for spatial abilities, and yet we have all these toys that get rid of our abilities even to be spatial.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Philip.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Professor Philip Servos is Canada Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience, and he teaches at Wilfrid Laurier University. Okay, I need some help with this, so I've called in some heavyweights to help me understand this Rubik's 360. The Mosley kids are competitive cubers. They enter and sometimes win Rubik's Cube competitions.
I'm Callum Mosley, and I'm 9 years old. I can solve the cube in 18 seconds.
I'm Emma. I'm 13 years old, and I can solve the cube in 30 seconds.
I'm Jack Mosley. I'm 14 years old, and I can solve the cube in 10 seconds.
Now let's see what happens when we give them this Rubik's 360. Can they solve it?
Okay. I'm just shaking it randomly and hoping the balls get to the outside.
Right at first glance, I can see it's going to be complicated.
I don't see any other way.
Can I give it a go?
Yeah, sure.
I'm stuck on step one.
It's pretty cool, except it doesn't make very much sense to me. It keeps rolling away from me.
That's the way it is.
You might be able to get a strategy off the internet, but
yeah,
other than that, I think you're pretty much on your own for this.
Jack and Emma tried their best to sort out the puzzle, but it's 9-year-old Callum who's tried hardest. And after a little over an hour of trying, he solved it. If you want to see Callum's victory lap, we've posted video to our blog, cbc.ca/spark. Okay, Callum, any advice?
I think shaking's pretty much the only way.
Thanks for the help, gang.
Bye, Nora.
Well, that's it for this 360 look at technology and culture. Spark is made this week by special guest star Dominic Girard, Dan Meisner, and me, Nora Young, and by
Bill Buxton,
Elizabeth Russ,
Tawana Hines,
Philip Servos,
David Edelstein,
Mark Doyle,
Jack Mosley,
Callum Mosley,
Emma Mosley,
Rick, and by
Will Shorts, and I have an associate with me typing in the background.
Stop by the blog if there's a topic you'd like to pursue in more depth, cbc.ca/spark. Hop on and join the conversation. Spark is made with Creative Commons music and effects. You can find the artists up at the blog. Until next time, puzzling things out with you, I'm Nora Young for Spark.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.